What is going on, people? So I had a great time hearing from Arlen Kolwick. He is the co-founder of BlockNet. We get his very intellectual and philosophical take on a whole bunch of different things. All the things that they've been doing at BlockNet, all the stuff that they plan to do, to even how the great white shark population is disappearing in South Africa. And he thinks he knows why. You're not going to want to miss this one. Please help us grow the family. Give us a comment and review on the Apple or Google Play Store. It's super quick and easy. Just scroll down, click the little stars, comment, and just help us grow the fam. So let's go check out the interview, and I'll catch you on the other side. What is going on, crypto family? So today we got Arlen Kolwick. He is the co-founder of BlockNet. So they've been around for quite a while. It's awesome to get you on the show and basically hear about you and what you guys are doing. So thanks a bunch for making time for us.
Oh, thank you. Great to be on the show.
Awesome, man. Cool. So, you know, kind of maybe tell us a little about yourself. You know, how'd you get into blockchain? You know, what part of the world do you live in right now? You know, just the basics.
Well, I got into blockchain in, I think, 2012. I was researching something in a field called meta ethics and, believe it or not, stumbled on the Bitcoin white paper. It blew my mind basically because, you know, someone had gone and built an actual currency using the very kind of theory of value that I was entertaining as a hypothesis. So that hooked me. I spent 9 months just researching everything down to the byte level. And I guess I haven't really left the academic side of things, but I definitely didn't stop doing crypto either. So I live in Cape Town at the moment, been here since 2017, and yeah, BlockNet is maturing, going from strength to strength, and I guess
it's awesome.
The latest strength is the thing we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, exciting. And then, you know, maybe some of your background just in general. I mean, you obviously sound highly educated. So, you know, what field did you come from, your education, that kind of background as well?
I'm actually trained in analytic philosophy, which sounds kind of left field for crypto, but you won't believe the things people were doing before they got into crypto and are now part of these projects. Not sure I'm in an especially strange position, actually. But for me, there's a real similarity in doing analytic philosophy and doing crypto protocol design, which is that you're solving an abstract problem. It's a problem that you can solve by thinking precisely and critically, and you need to be able to kind of think in systems and figure out sort of funny solutions to things that probably people haven't thought of before. So, I mean, you know, there's a space for what I do in the crypto space. There's, you know, that's a very small part of the entire project. I'm not an important piece of the project in pretty much every sense of the word. I'm an anti-manager. Last thing I want is to control anything in the project or to have any kind of real authority. It's decentralized. And fortunately, we've got some really, really great people in the project who can do many things that I'm terrible at.
It's what makes a great team. So, and then what made you guys pick South Africa? Is it the sharks or, you know, what brought you guys to South Africa?
I am South African. I left South Africa in 2011. My wife and I got married and we went off to Oxford. We were there for several years. And then we came back here for a little bit and then went back there again for another stint. And I guess after a while, we realized we wanted to be settled somewhere instead of kind of temporarily in some place. And it turns out the sharks disappeared. Kind of crazy.
Did the surfers all get together and go eat them or what? The surfers turn the tide?
It's kind of weird. The leading hypothesis is that some orcas figured out how to kill the great white sharks in order to eat their livers, right? Literally like what people think is the truth. And you can't be sure because it's hard to study. But a shark's liver is about a third of its body weight. And it's all just filled with kind of this fatty, oily substance. It's a big store of energy, quite different to what our livers do. And a pod of orcas just decided they were going to like kill any shark they could find. So you got these like literally these 5.5 meter sharks washing up on the shore every now and then. You know, that was a couple of years ago, and now there's just pretty much no great white sharks around. It's crazy.
Wow. Survival of the fittest, I guess, right? So, you know, now are the surfers now scared of orcas, or are they, you know, they're just out there just having a good time now?
They aren't. I haven't heard of any orca attacks on humans, but there is another top predator shark moving in. It's this thing that's kind of a prehistoric shark and used to live in the kelp beneath where the great white sharks would hunt seals.
I saw that. It was Jason Statham, I think. And I think it was called Megalodon or something. Yeah.
Yeah, no, not that big, fortunately. So there's sort of a long thing with a different number of gills to modern sharks. They look pretty weird. And I don't know if they're attack any people, but they're around and creeping in. Maybe the orcas will start going for them too.
They're like, next. Yeah. That's awesome.
Shark liver.
Cool, man. So what is it you guys are doing at BlockNet? I mean, we've heard the name for a long time. You guys are, you know, kind of like the new, you guys, I guess, like the new internet. So is that how you guys, you know, kind of describe yourself? Is kind of like 3.0?
Something like that, yeah. Although I guess the way people are using terms like Web 3.0 these days means that we play a specific part in all of that. We provide ways of interacting with other blockchains without your having to download the blockchain locally. And that's really important. And it does it in a completely decentralized way so that you don't have to trust in any intermediaries, and therefore that the unique and disruptive properties of blockchains are preserved through the use of our technology. My personal take on it is that we're providing kind of a bottom layer foundational type of function in the emerging interchain space. But on top of that, there are going to be all kinds of things, some of which have been built already. So for me, at the bottom, it's something like our X-Router technology, which was released in beta very recently, which means that today you can run this thing, you can interact with kind of every blockchain out there and not have to download it locally, which is amazing, because I don't know if you've tried to download Ethereum and run a full node, but it's crazy. Your internet connection might not keep up. Your hard drive will just fall. It's wild.
Yeah, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger every single day too. So it's a lot of storage, yeah, for sure. But for people that don't know, like, what do they consider like Web 1.0? What do they consider Web 2.0? And what is like Web 3.0? You know, just in crayon for us in the cheap seats.
All right. Well, Web 1.0 was, you know, the early internet, TCP/IP and DNS, and, you know, the foundational stuff there that made it all take off. Web 2 is kind of the internet we have today, where it's dominated by the likes of Google and Facebook, but, you know, is a very useful thing. It's scaled like you cannot believe, and we all spend more than half our day on it. Now, Web 3.0 initially was a thing called the semantic web, which is kind of cool. It allows programs to learn facts about, you know, the state of whatever. There's a sort of a language type structure in the way that they can process information. But since Ethereum began, there was this kind of alternative version of Web 3.0, which overlaps. It's the programmable money paradigm. And so what we're seeing only very recently is the so-called DeFi or decentralized finance thing really taking off in Ethereum. And that's a whole bunch of cool financial fintech startups making these sort of trustless products. And it's on the back of contracts being able to talk to each other and being able to interoperate in all kinds of really cool ways, where the whole thing is, you know, as I said, trustless. So it's kind of the beginnings of a new financial system, I hope. And I guess to me, this is where our X-Router technology comes in. Because at the moment, it's not difficult to get a couple of contracts on Ethereum working together. And that's why today you can go with your Ether or any token on Ethereum and use something like Uniswap to swap it for DAI or Ether. And then from there, you could send it to Dharma or Compound, and those will give you kind of amazing rates of interest on the crypto that you have. And then on top of that, you can go and borrow other crypto with your crypto. So it's, you know, it's quite basic compared to mature financial products like we get in the traditional world, but it's awesome. The thing is,
but it's awesome.
Awesome. It's so much fun. You don't need anyone's permission. You don't need to speak to bureaucrats. You don't need to fill in forms or stand in queues. It's wonderful. The thing is, though, that stuff is only on Ethereum. You know, if you've got Bitcoins, you can't really do anything useful in that space without something like X-Router. Now, what this enables is you could have some crypto on any blockchain, and there could be some really great contract on a different blockchain, and you could get them talking to each other. I'm not pitching this to kind of regular users of, you know, DeFi products. This is really pitched at crypto developers, right? Because they will be able, instead of having to rewrite some wonderful contract themselves, maybe in a different language on another chain, and deal with the 2 years of development that might take and the very scarce and expensive skills that it will probably take, they could just orchestrate that contract with whatever else is out there on any other blockchain, and off they go. And that's actually what apps look like today. Old centralized apps, everything you use on your phone. As an app developer, you don't build your own payment gateway. You don't build your own like one-time password or two-factor authentication service. You just use Firebase or whatever else you want to use. And so your app is actually an orchestration of, you know, 5-10 different APIs that are just out there. And that's why it's economical to build apps. That's why you can do these things and, you know, do them cheaply and quickly, and then hopefully you get traction, and off you go and you build a business on top of it. In crypto, it hasn't been like that. It's been really hard. It's taken a very long time. It's because there just hasn't been a kind of something like the API ecosystem. So what I hope XRouter becomes is the foundation of the, what you might call the token ecosystem or the interchain ecosystem, where people can just simply and securely orchestrate contracts together on different blockchains and build who knows what, pretty much anything.
It's incredible. And so you said the beta of this is live now. So you've kind of solved, in essence, the interoperability issue already of sorts?
Absolutely. I believe we have solved it. I believe there are important differences in our solution to the other so-called blockchain interoperability projects that make ours different in like in ways that are critical to the development of an ecosystem. So like, let's say it was the early days of the internet, and instead of something like TCP/IP, which doesn't privilege any one website over another, we had a different situation where it was a bit like VHS and Betamax, where these two technologies weren't unopinionated, right? They had these sort of vested interests in people using them. And if you use the one, you couldn't use the other. Now, imagine that it happened with the internet. Imagine some websites were kind of given this central privileged role over some others. That would be a disaster, because all that we would have got is a big turf war between, you know, 50-something startups, all essentially trying to compete for market share for providing the same service. What we had instead was an unopinionated standard, just a protocol that anyone could use. And that's why we got the internet, which is an incredible thing. It's a huge kind of landmark in the history of humanity, I think. And I think that with the interchain, we're in a very similar position where we might end up with competing opinionated protocols, but we might end up with an unopinionated interchain protocol that is just agnostic about which blockchains are used. And I think it's really important that we go the unopinionated route, because if we don't, we won't get the tremendous ecosystem benefits that we saw with the creation of the internet. Unfortunately, the other major blockchain interoperability projects are opinionated. You have to use their blockchain in order to interact with other blockchains. They don't require you using it in the same way as each other. They're different solutions, but they're all opinionated as far as we can tell. And that to me is quite a problem. We really want an opinionated interchain protocol that just doesn't lock anyone into any one blockchain. And that's what we've provided now.
That's incredible. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I've said for a long time now is we kind of have enough blockchains out there. Now we need some kind of hub that can allow them all to talk to each other, right? So that way it doesn't matter if you're a developer and you're building everything in Solidity or you're doing everything in C++, it doesn't matter. You've got this hub that basically just kind of differentiates everything, makes it, you know, readable to the computers and whatnot, and it doesn't matter what you build on. You know, you've got something that can interpret it. So that sounds awesome. So when you say it's live now in the beta, like what can we do? Like say, for instance, I have a decentralized exchange. Well, actually, you guys have a decentralized exchange, right? You guys have actually shown that you guys can build on it. So rather than me giving you an example, why don't you talk about your decentralized exchange? And then I'll ask another question.
One of the most fun things I've done in the last couple of weeks, I got the decentralized exchange fired up on my computer. And then instead of running a full Bitcoin node, a full Litecoin node and doing some trades, I ran a very early version of a Lite multi-wallet, still in kind of alpha. I mean, it's not released to the general public, but this multi-wallet uses XRouter. So it doesn't have any chains locally, but it doesn't depend on some company out there running a server and you're having to rely on that server to relay transactions for you. It connects to a peer-to-peer network. This is the BlockNet service node network. right? And what it does is it queries any given service node when it wants to know about the state of the blockchain or it wants to make a transaction. And if you want to be extra careful about what's going on, you just query more service nodes and more service nodes. And if they all give you the same answer, then you can be very confident about the truth of the matter. You just don't have to trust any one of them. Now, this method is called an SPV proof. It's in the Bitcoin white paper, so it's nothing new or weird. A lot of wallets use it, but none of them have the network that we've built over the years that allows us to do this. We got like a ton of these nodes running a whole lot of different blockchains, right? And so if you go and you query one of them, they can go, okay, well, on this blockchain, this is what's happening, and off you go. I ran this wallet locally. No blockchain downloaded locally. I integrated it with the decentralized exchange just over its API. And off we go. I can make trades in a completely decentralized way without downloading any blockchains locally. That's a dream. Yeah. Just wait till it goes to mobile. It's going to be awesome.
And so with the exchange, I mean, you guys have liquidity there? You guys have users there? I mean, obviously people would want to be using this, you know, tomorrow. Like, what's the biggest, I guess, between like Ether Delta and your guys' decentralized exchange, like what's, you know, some of the biggest like key points that are different from there? I mean, do you guys have as much liquidity, less, you know, because a lot of people don't understand. It's like, hey, you know, it's 2 cents on CoinMarketCap, but I'm paying 20 cents for it. It's like, well, yeah, you have to match buyer and seller because there's not enough volume or enough, you know, liquidity there on the actual exchange. So have you guys figured that part out yet?
Yeah. Our volume is ramping up. Just from week to week. I'm aware that some of your viewers might view this in a month's time. So I won't quote volume, but anyone can go to blockdx.co and check out the figures. And there's a whole lot of other great information on that website. When it comes to the advantages of BlockDex over something like Ether Delta haven't decentralized their order book. And to my mind, that doesn't qualify it as a decentralized exchange. I think it should be called a sort of a semi-centralized exchange or just a centralized exchange. Because when you think about it, being a decentralized exchange isn't just about decentralized settlement. It's not just about atomic swaps. There are at least four things you always do at an exchange. Capital is stored somewhere. So if it's a centralized exchange, you would go and deposit coins at the exchange. Then orders need to be broadcast out. So an order book needs to be kind of compiled and broadcast. Then orders have to be matched. So if you're wanting to buy and someone's wanting to sell, there has to be some entity finding these orders and matching them together. And then finally, the last stage is the settlement. So after you've gone and made a match, then I'll send you Litecoin and you send me Bitcoin and off we go. Unless all four of those are decentralized, I just don't think that one can call one's exchange decentralized. Put it this way, one of the real problems in the crypto exchange space is we just can't tell what the exchanges are doing. There's front running, there's perhaps selling like lists of like people's stop orders, right? There's that permits things like wash trading, all sorts of nonsense. There could be privileged access given to certain parties so that they get the best orders first. We can't really tell. There could be fake orders on the book. There could be, and I think this one's probably the most common, the ability to trade with sort of infinite funds. You don't really need funds. You just do whatever you want and make a whole bunch of volume. I mean, all of these things are everywhere. Maybe not exactly everywhere, but they're all over the place. And this is a huge issue. And this is what you get when you don't decentralize the order book and the order matching. And so an exchange like Ether Delta might have exactly those problems. And that's precisely what we're trying to get away from.
One of the things too that I think you left out that's probably more important than everything else you said is Ether Delta is just Ethereum. You guys are other cryptos as well, right?
Yeah, so, that is also an important point.
It's like, I can only trade tokens. But with your DEX, you guys could actually do Bitcoin to, you know, some random ERC or Bitcoin to Litecoin or Ethereum to Ripple or whatever, right?
Yeah, exactly. I would say, just to play devil's advocate, that a determined developer could build something fancy and difficult that allows you to, for example, park your Bitcoins in a peg on Ethereum, and then create some ERC20 token, which is, you know, like kind of Bitcoin, and then you can go and you trade it on EtherDelta or somewhere else. I mean, that's probably been done, and I'm not specifically against it. I'm just not that interested in it, because to me, the real potential for the future of the financial ecosystem is in the interchain space, where these blockchains are talking to each other. And it also just makes the design of a decentralized exchange kind of simple, right? If you solve like that big hard problem first, then you've got something amazing where you can use the same wallet that like you have on your computer or your phone that you trust, that you know, you don't have to go and send it to some other nonsense. You just trade directly from that wallet. I think that's great. I mean, imagine EtherDelta or something had an issue, and then your Bitcoin's sort of stuck in a peg, and then you've got some kind of wrapped Bitcoin and Ethereum, and like you've got to interact with some funny contract to get it out. And it sounds pretty horrible, if you ask me. I just want it simpler.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, we already have the coins. We should be trading those, not coming up with a substitute token to mimic a coin that also requires a third party to actually prove that there's something, the original coin, you know, backing that token, right? So So you guys have a super ambitious project, and you guys have been around for a long time. You guys are delivering stuff constantly. So you got the X router, you guys have your exchange. What's in the next, you know, year or two? What can we expect from BlockNet?
Well, I think the big thing that's coming up next is that SPV multi-wallet that I mentioned earlier. I think that will remove the last major barrier to entry for the decentralized exchange, because let's face it, a lot of people don't want to download even one blockchain, never mind two, so that they can trade. Never mind maintaining them and making sure they have enough of an internet connection to sync up before they trade. And these things can kind of kill the user experience. So I think once this comes out, which is sooner than expected, I'm going to say, given how it feels to use today, it's going to be huge. So I think that is our next big milestone as far as the kind of users are concerned. There are other more back-end milestones that are really big. We are moving Codebase, so we're going to be moving to Bitcoin, whereas prior to this, we were on PIVX, which is kind of from Dash, which is kind of from Peercoin, went back a long way. That's going to give us a whole lot more stability. It's going to give us all the latest updates from the Bitcoin Codebase. And so I think it's a better basis to move forward. And this is important for users, because a decentralized exchange really needs to have a rock solid code base. We don't want trouble.
No, you're right. Bitcoin is definitely that. It's been rock solid. It's got like less than 0.01% downtime since its inception, right? So they're very methodical with the way they change things, and they have a really solid team. So if that's your guys' bedrock of sorts and you're building from there up, that's pretty incredible. That's awesome.
Yeah, it should be good.
So a lot of really cool stuff coming from you guys in the future, it sounds like.
Yeah, that multi-wallet's going to be awesome. There's so many other things going on. I'm just not sure if it's worth really mentioning them. We tend to be quite cautious about this stuff, because it really just causes a lot of problems if you hype some things that like aren't really built yet and are really early, and people get excited by them. Or maybe some other things that like we haven't really like thought through and become convinced that we're doing kind of next or in a specific sequence, because design is an open-ended process, and sometimes something looks great, and then sometimes later you realize it's really complicated and it's going to take longer. I think the best bet is to look on our roadmaps, because those come out regularly enough, and they will keep everyone updated on the many, many things that we do.
Yeah, you guys have done a ton already. So for people that want to, you know, check out all the stuff that you've done, we'll make sure to post the link there, and they can start using the exchange and check out you know, all the cool stuff that you guys have been doing with XRouter and your new wallet to come. So exciting stuff. You know, we could probably talk for the next, you know, 45 minutes to an hour just on all the stuff that you guys have done and are doing. But, you know, there's enough information out there already. So what I like to do is find out more about, you know, kind of the founder a little bit and, you know, kind of what makes him tick, right? So one of the questions I've asked for years is, you know, what's one of the most important books you've ever read that kind of, you know, shaped your life that you recommend other people should read as well?
This is probably going to sound like a joke, but it's absolutely serious. I discovered a 17th century philosopher known as John of St. Thomas, otherwise known as John Poinsot, and his stuff changed my life. It literally took me 6 years to understand what he was saying. And that's not because he was originally writing in Latin. It's just that it's ridiculously technical. I don't know how much to get into this.
I guess maybe just in a nutshell, what was so important about it?
Well, as a philosopher, I think, well, put it this way, before someone becomes a philosopher, there's normally something that drives them. In my case, it was two things. It was just a drive to make sense of things in general. I really like coming up with systems that kind of explain what's going on well. The other one is I just had this sort of hunch about relations. Like there was something about being in relation to things that I thought was important to how anything works. And I mean, in a sense, this is kind of coming full circle because in 2012, I was reading the Bitcoin white paper and going, Satoshi said, a chain of digital signatures, right? I define a coin as a chain of digital signatures. And that literally just means that a coin isn't a separate data object. It just is its own history. I sent it to you and you sent it to someone else. And like, that's literally a coin.
It's just check marks on a ledger, actually. It's not even really a token or a coin.
Yeah. It's extraordinary. You know, this is, in philosophy, this is a difficult argument to make. You don't, in the modern period, i.e. from the sort of 17th century onward, find a lot of useful work. And so I struggled. Along comes John Poinsot, who was forgotten for almost exactly 300 years. But in 1632, he writes this colossal 600-page treatise on signs. And that itself was part of like this enormous volume, kind of like a, you can't see my hands, they're too far apart for the camera, like that much of a library shelf in Latin. And this thing just gets lost. But I got into it. I guess to be able to have a way of making sense of some extraordinarily thorny questions in philosophy that then can make sense of that and give you a kind of a general theory of reality. It's freaking nerdy, but that is life-changing.
It only took you 6 years to get through it, so.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. Very hard going, but I love it.
Awesome. If you could change anything in the world, man, if you could be, you'd be president for the day, I guess it'd be different over there in South Africa, but if you could change anything in the world, it'd be the way people dress, what they say, what they do, regulations, anything, what would you change?
I know what I'd do. It's very, very hard. This is not my idea. This is Alistair McIntyre's idea. He wrote this book called After Virtue, which is extraordinary and it's well worth reading. He makes the case that outside of kind of simple societies with where pretty much every member has the same reasons for giving value to things, you just don't get coherent morality. So outside of kind of an Aristotelian system that maybe made sense until the end of the Middle Ages, we've just had ethical chaos, right? It's a horrible problem because we can't even agree on like the basic intuitions or basic sort of moral principles that guide our judgments. And so you just have like complete freaking chaos. So if I were the president for a day, I would start an extraordinarily well-funded institute to pursue the creation of a shared understanding of public goods. And then there would be big national conversations and everyone can come to understand the good and not in the same ways, because you can't tell people what to think. It would allow people the opportunity to think through things in ways that they're not exposed to. And maybe some really great researchers leading the thing would come up with some ways that are common to all of us. And then you can actually have conversations that come to agreement where people are kind of rationally obliged to kind of respect that conversation and agree. Hugely important thing. Don't know if it's possible, but I'd straight up try.
Very interesting. And then the last one's always a fun one, you know. So what's the craziest thing you've ever done that you can tell us that's not going to land you in jail?
Craziest thing I've ever done? I don't know. Some crazy things are just like...
Not crazy to you, but to everybody else.
Like, not, they don't make good stories. I think at some point... Yeah, I think I know what it was. At some point, I'd been living in Johannesburg, also a South African city. And I decided to jump off my own map. I was just, my life needed some changes. Some things were coming to an end there. And it really seemed to me like the best course of action was to not, like, was to jump so far off the ways I knew how to do things and the resources I had to kind of pay the bills and all those sort of important things that I, you know, I just would not know where I was going to be going. And so I went on a big tour around the country. I didn't book like an ending to this. It was just kind of open-ended. And I had all kinds of adventures. A lot of them were kind of quite strange. Like, wasn't really sure where what I was going to be doing that evening, but I kind of had a feeling it would work out fine. And then I'd like meet some people and have this whole big adventure. And it was wonderful.
How long did it last for?
That was about 3.5 months until I ended up in Cape Town. This was 2010. And then I kind of hung around a little bit in Cape Town. And then I met this girl and I kind of made excuses to stay in Cape Town. And then we got married and then we went to Oxford and like kind of, it changed fundamentally. It was a wonderful decision in retrospect.
Yeah, no, it's kind of like one of those Australian walkabouts, right? So you go out there, just explore for 3.5 months, come back, plant your roots. Now you're in blockchain. So awesome.
Exactly.
Very, very cool. Well, hey, we'll make sure to get all the links out there for you. Make sure to get this video out, you know, as quick as we can. I really appreciate you coming on, telling your story, telling us about BlockNet. Got a lot of impressive and ambitious things going on, and we wish you nothing but success, buddy. So thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Beatles. Thanks so much for your time. It's great to be on the show.
All right, likewise. God bless.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Big thanks to Arlen. Appreciate you, buddy, coming on and telling us all about BlockNet, as well as what's going on with the great white shark population. That's pretty interesting. So hopefully those orcas don't start coming after people, right? But it was awesome meeting you, hearing your story, and all the cool stuff that you're doing at BlockNet. Appreciate you. Just a friendly reminder, Crypto Beatles shows are never financial advice, recommendations, or trading strategies. The views expressed here are solely that of Robert Beatles and his guests. Robert Beatles is the co-founder of the Monarch Wallet, host of TradingView Sessions, Crypto Beatles on YouTube, and on several entities. Robert's opinions here do not reflect that of those entities. Some information shared here may not actually be factual. These shows are for information and entertainment purposes only. Never invest a single Satoshi or penny in anything without first seeking the counsel and advice of a professional financial advisor. Robert Beatles is not a financial expert or advisor. Investing in anything is super dangerous. You can lose all of your money, so always trade at your own risk. Please help us grow the family. Give us a comment and review on the Apple or Google Play Store. It's super quick and easy. Just scroll down, click the little stars, comment, and just help us grow the family. All right. God bless you. Love you. Till the next one. Talk to you soon.